wherever you travel around the villages, you might be on foot on a village path, I often ride a bicycle, you're always meeting Americans. It's like they're thick on the ground. But you never meet them in person. They're not there. Yet the impact of their thinking and what they're doing is everywhere. I mean, affecting and determining the ways in which people relate. Now, unfortunately, because they're not there, you can't engage with them.
You're listening to a download from Grace Baptist Mission. Welcome to Across the Nations, a program that explores gospel work in different cultures around the world. The presenter is Jim Sayers, GBM's Communications Director. In the first of three programs, Jim interviews Jim Harries, Chairman of the Alliance for Vulnerable Mission. In this episode, Jim Harries explains the concept of vulnerable mission, the impact of the Me Too movement on the work of NGOs, the recent debate about universal basic incomes, and the impact of Western aid on Indigenous understandings of marriage.
Well, it's good to welcome to the studio Jim Harries. Jim is the Chairman of the Alliance for Vulnerable Mission. What is the Alliance for Vulnerable Mission?
The Alliance for Vulnerable Mission, we propose that some missionaries from the West should do their work in the majority world using local languages and local resources.
Not to bring in huge amounts of Western culture and Western money and so on, but to try and engage locally with and mobilize locally.
Right. In ministry. So we're not saying you don't have to be dependent on Western resources, perhaps for where you're living or your food even. But when you move to where you're engaging with the people in ministry, that you go with your pockets empty kind of thing. So meet them on the level and then engage with them in their languages.
Now, the question in my mind is that this is a very contemporary issue all of a sudden, because we have the Me Too movement, which started in Hollywood and then came to attack British politicians, then, to everybody's surprise, started attacking major NGOs. And we suddenly have a discovery that there are charity workers who are exploiting vulnerable people for sex in the developing world. Is that a shock, a surprise to someone like you who's working in Kenya?
I'm not sure whether it's shock or surprised. I think what I can say that I've had as a principle that I've communicated different times over the years, foundation for wanting to do effective work in the majority world, control your sexuality. I'm single, maintain your celibacy. And if you can't do that, from my understanding, you sink, and that's prerequisite.
And so for some of these NGOs coming in with no Christian basis, they're just a big aid agency with a big pot of money, a charity determined to do good, but in a completely secular mindset. They're bringing in Western secular values into countries and cultures that would be very, very far from that.
I was surprised when I heard these revelations from Oxfam. Of course, I was unaware of the kind of things that were going on. But what it very soon made me think is that that is a kind of a leg up for Christian organizations. Now, I'm not saying Christian organizations are perfect, but yet the basic ground rules are pretty clear. You're either monogamous and you confine yourself with sexually to your own wife, or if you're single, you're single,
And you're celibate. Yeah.
And you're celibate, right. So that was quite mind-blowing, actually, to find the secular world critiquing secular organizations for not maintaining Christian moral values.
And then some of those people coming back and saying, well, we're not hurting anybody. Why can't we behave like that sort of thing, which is quite openly revealing. Now, we should say at this point, Jim, you work in Kenya. You're a missionary in Kenya. How are you supported there?
Right. I've been in Africa now almost 30 years, essentially doing Bible teaching, particularly with orientation to indigenous churches using the Luo and Swahili languages. I'm sent by a number of churches in the UK, and at the moment kind of seconded directly to a church there in Kenya.
So you're not sent through a mission agency, you're sent through a group of supporting churches.
Right. I was with a mission agency some years back, but for 25 years now, I've been in that sense independent. Now, I did commander, an American church who was working in Africa for a number of those years, but now that's ended, so I'm working directly with a rather indigenous African church.
And you're answerable to a sending church here in the UK.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you guard and cherish that relationship.
Yeah, yeah, very much valued. I'm in the process of visiting those churches now in this short time in the UK.
Okay.
Very valued.
Now, you're actually in quite an interesting situation because you're then able to critique what the world mission movement in general is doing without an allegiance to a major agency or whatever. Mm. So it gives you the freedom to talk. You have lived, and you continue to live, in a Kenyan village in a very down-to-earth, grassroots sort of way. How, in a village like that, is a lot of the work of Western mission and mission agencies, as well as the wider sort of NGO organizations, how is that seen by people in a village setting?
Yeah, obviously very desirable. These people invariably have butter that can be put on the bread. And it's very, very hard to be involved in that kind of project without offering incentives to accept what you're offering. Now, that also, of course, has its problematic in that, let's say, it tends to corruption. Because if you have foreigners coming to engage in your community with their limited understanding, and very soon becomes apparent they have their own deadlines and their own requirements, and even the money they have to spend, you know, they're working according to certain requirements, and they've been told, for example, you need to reach that community. If you're a member of that community, then you know you're being reached. There's money involved, so you need to make sure that you get your slice of that money.
The African will think, well, here's a Westerner, he's got money to spend, I must get my slice of that money.
Well, I wouldn't, in another sense, pretend to be able to identify what an African's thinking. I'm speaking in English, and English has its particular categories. So African people may use English, and therefore they use categories that we think are familiar, but that doesn't mean that underlying it is what we might be understanding. So that's how I'm trying to explain what, to me, is happening in let's say, the African mind when NGOs and other bodies come. Now, I say that to some extent because I would caution my colleagues at getting involved with foreigners, because often there are ramifications and implications that follow in due course from whatever relationship you build with them.
When you say your colleagues, what do you mean?
Well, folks who I engage with in the villages, in the churches, who regularly or periodically in different ways are approached by foreign bodies. I mean, some of them are working for foreign bodies and earning salaries and so forth. And I'm not saying that they shouldn't do so. Obviously, a lot of people get a lot of benefit, but the relationships are rarely straightforward. I mean, I think you'd be aware between cultures, you might say you think you're saying something simple and something straightforward, assuming the wider context is the same as the one you have at home, when in reality, given the extant context, what you're saying might be a little bit extraordinary and is likely to be understood in different ways, yeah.
And so we have all sorts of misunderstandings that take place without us ever really intending it. Have you got specific examples of how that happens in your own experience?
Well, a very specific example that I've recently looked a little bit into, some people who are giving direct. Yeah, I saw something on the BBC and on the web about it, and I'd heard some of my colleagues actually talk about this and said, when those people come, I tell them to go away. You know.
Now, this is interesting because I saw this in the New York Times and when I was in an airport, and then picked up on it here on the BBC. Yeah, some NGOs, some government aid agencies are building a system of direct payments, direct and putting a basic minimum income into the pockets of an entire group of villagers to raise them up. That's the idea, isn't it? What's the intention, and what's the practical reality?
Well, the intention, without having studied in detail, in some ways you can say, well, that's wonderful, because they're looking towards a universal basic income so that everyone, I guess, globally is provided for. So contrary to Marx's fears, you know, the capitalists would become ever more powerful and everyone else would be no more than a slave. People are giving a living income. And then presuming due course, that would be a prosperous income. You know, I guess that's how the theory is put together. What the theories tend to overlook is the relationship between, let's say, the material and the spiritual. Because in our Western dualistic view, we tend to look at material things as kind of self-encompassed, you know, self-fulfilling. Whereas in traditional societies, and this has been explored particularly by anthropologists, a gift is never free. And gift-giving is a central social institution. Again, in many parts of the world I'm familiar with, you can't refuse a gift. So if you can't refuse a gift and someone's offering something, in other words, they're getting leverage over you. And that obviously is then what people are fearing. What leverage are they going to exert on my life and how they're going to manipulate me? And then the traditional gift, of course, should be contributed. And then the chapter closes and now you return what you can. And then that becomes a pastime of demonstrating who is most capable of giving a most generous gift. But if the gift is ongoing, then it becomes a kind of almost imprisonment into a receiving status that results in a decline in spiritual state, if you like. So in other words, people are thinking, well, one day I'm going to have to pay back. What am I going to be asked to pay? And when you ask yourself, well, how do we get this notion of free gift? Of course, it comes straight from Christ and the gospel. And that's a history that we've had in the West for generations that we forget. That our thinking is so deeply influenced by what Christ did for us that we forget that other people haven't had that influence.
And so your colleagues, friends, neighbours in the village where you are, they know that there are villages down the road in the area around Lake Victoria where NGO staff have come in and said, we're going to pay everybody in this village a basic guaranteed income for every person in that village. And they see that as enslavement.
Well, they raise red flags. What's going to come out of this? And, I mean, I'm not making that decision for them, but I kind of say, yeah, you need to raise some flags. Someone's making you dependent on them. And someone making you dependent on them, there's an agenda. A dependency, I'm sure you're aware, is already a massive issue. But this is a very direct, you've been receiving the money now. I mean, what's going to follow?
Hmm. Now, here's another way in which it happens. One of the things that you notice in any majority world country is the growth of mobile phones. It's a very simple technology, but for rural dispersed populations, it's a great technology because you need very little infrastructure to make it work. Mm-hmm. And you can produce basic mobile phones to satisfy their need. Now, in Kenya, you have the M-Pesa system, which is can you explain what that is?
Yeah, it's essentially a means of sending money through your mobile phone. So there's complexity in detail, and I don't engage with it in detail. I do the simple systems. If I want to send a friend some money, I can send them up to £1 for free. More money, I'll pay a little fee, and then it arrives on their phone, and they can either send it on or pay a bill with it, or they can go to a kiosk and convert it into cash and so forth.
And so it becomes, your mobile phone becomes your banker? And it becomes a way of controlling your life. Is there a sense in which, you know, the M-Pesa system has sort of taken over commerce and daily trading relationships and all that sort of thing? Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing?
I see it as very enabling in many ways. If, for example, you want to purchase a certain product in a distant town, then say the person puts his product onto a bus that's transporting it to where you are, then you receive the product, you pay the person. You don't have to then go there with the money and so forth. Now, without being involved in business, it seems to me this has facilitated a lot of different small business, if you like. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But at the same time, it's a Western technology coming and starting to deliver everything physically. People see their physical needs being met by money, money, money. And it's reinforcing this Western secular understanding of the economy, of our physical needs, of our secular worldview.
Right. I mean, in other senses, there's a lot of things that need to cause us ongoing alarm. A system that's comes from outside, that's guided and directed from the outside, that's given to us in Africa for our benefit, so to speak. If things were to change outside, they might say, well, we haven't got time to deal with Africa anymore. We better cut them off. Then the systems may collapse. And I mean, there's other equivalents. Another one that often comes to mind, ARVs for people with AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
Antiretroviral drugs.
Right. Yeah. Well, there are thousands and thousands, probably totally millions of people who are totally dependent for their very lives on taking these pills on a daily basis. And they're subsidized free, I gather, by American money or at least foreign money. So, you know, if someone ever cuts those funds, well, we have masses of funerals, you know, just mass death. And all those kind of mechanisms inhibit, let's say, independent innovation. Because if you fall outside of what is considered desirable by the people providing these funds and these systems, you might be in deep trouble.
Dependency shows itself in a myriad variety of ways, sort of thing. Yeah. Okay. What impact does Western aid have on the ground? Is it a means for good? Is it corrupting?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say that categorically, good, bad. A comment that I've made recently in talking to different people is that wherever you travel around the villages, you might be on foot on a village path. I often ride a bicycle. You're always meeting Americans. It's like they're thick on the ground. But you never meet them in person. They're not there. Yet the impact of their thinking and what they're doing is everywhere. I mean, affecting and determining the ways in which people relate. Now, unfortunately, because they're not there, you can't engage with them.
Can you explain what you mean by saying you're always meeting Americans? Give me some instances.
Right. The activity by overseas bodies, whether it be NGOs, I mean, I don't know, again, the details that are there. I'm going by overheard conversations, for example, and also seeing the way people orient their lives in a way that you can say, well, this wouldn't make sense in this context. They're getting this orientation from somewhere else. So realize there's foreign bodies essentially using finance to encourage people to behave in certain ways. Now, those foreign bodies increasingly are controlled from way outside the boundaries of African states. Now, in theory, the reason that is done is, of course, so as to front local people. Because the last thing you want in these days of anti-colonialism is the white man on the ground, because it looks terrible that he seems to be the boss and yet he doesn't know. But he's not now frequently the white man controlling, but he's not anywhere near the ground. Unfortunately, that means that he has more and more of the power without getting the insights and the understanding that he would acquire were he there, especially were he or she there for an extended period so they could learn the language and see how the language engaged with the culture. And then you ask yourself, if someone were familiar with the context here, would they still be prescribing this particular behavioral action or solution, you know? So that's what I mean. You meet them, they're not there, but it's almost like they're ghost. The people sitting wherever they are sitting in their offices, often, I guess, in the West, their impact is moving around the villages.
What sort of things do they impact?
Well, relationships. If you look at gender, for example, we have in the West a very deeply entrenched, I don't say in the negative way, notion that marriage should be built on love. A man should love his wife and the wife should love her husband, and that love is what produces ongoing relationship. Now, that's a very difficult thing to uphold in the West, and it is everywhere. In other parts of the world, I think love has been seen as much less foundational, and the tensions that arise in close relationship are evident, and people see relationships being perpetuated by other means. One of those means is dependency. Now, classically, dependence of a wife on a husband for provision, for land, for honor and so forth. Now, of course, it works the other way around as well. So I can say African women are extraordinarily powerful because they're the only ones accessing the kitchen. So if the man upsets a wife, he doesn't get a meal. So this mutual dependency is what keeps marriages together. Now, one way of undercutting that or undermining that dependency is to make the wife independent of her husband economically. So if you offer her certain direct benefits, perhaps through a project, then she starts to think to herself, well, why do I need him? You know, so aid in this sense, particularly when it's gender directed, can interfere with marriage. Now, if it's not gender directed, then let's say by default it will go into male hands. Now, that has its own implication, because then the man is further empowered and the woman is left. But if you empower the woman, that undermines a widespread, really, I think, situation in which wives remain faithful to their husbands and families because there's nowhere else to go. Now, you might think that's not a good reason for doing that, but in the long term, I think it is good for a wife to be faithful to husband and family, and maybe not having anywhere else to go isn't so bad, because otherwise that somewhere else would be deceiving us that it's better than where we are. You know, the grass is greener on the other side. So I think certainly in traditional societies, the mutual dependence of husband and wife perpetuates marriage, and that can be undermined when outside aid comes in particular, following particular avenues.
And there can be a strong political agenda there as well, that the aid agency says, well, we want to empower women because we're strongly feminist. You know, why should they be living in this patriarchal society? And so they've come in, they've judged it according to their Western preconceptions, and they haven't actually understood how the dynamic works in a very, very different culture. And so they've imposed a Western attitude on a rural village society that actually operates in a completely different way,
mm-hmm.
and where Western categories just fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. That maybe that woman isn't exploited and isn't oppressed. She's actually just as strong a part of that relationship as the husband is.
Right.
But in a different way.
Yeah.
And according to categories that we haven't understood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so we tend to go and visit and scratch our heads, because all the men are sitting under the tree talking and smoking, and the women are working in the fields and things like that. What's going on? We can't understand it. We can't process it because it doesn't conform to our Western stereotypes. Sort of. Yeah.
You've been listening to Across the Nations, a download from Grace Baptist Mission, presented by Jim Sayers and produced by Dan Bryant. In the next episode, Jim explores with Jim Harries the current views on the importance of integral mission, the value of true generosity, and the importance of using Indigenous languages in mission. You can download many more programmes like this from the resources page of our website, gbm.org.uk. Grace Baptist Mission exists to help Grace Baptist churches support their missionaries.